Welcome to the NeuroClinic. And today we have Alex Rose, who is a clinical psychologist working at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability and a PhD researcher at the University of Glasgow. And Alex is talking to us about her broad spectrum of experience working with people with severe traumatic brain injuries. So welcome to the NeuroClinic podcast, and we're very excited today to have Alex Rose joining us, who I'm sure is going to tell us a lot about herself, where she works, and most excitingly, her PhD that she's been working on for the last 3 years. And we've got Ingram Wright here as well, and my co-host.
We're getting better at this, Cleaner, aren't we? Although that's my brief hello interjection was mistimed.
Someday we'll get it.
We'll get it.
So, Alex, I'm just going to be, a bit cheeky and hand over to you to introduce yourself because I don't want to get it wrong.
Thank you very much for having me. I am going to excuse any other strange noises than my voice. I do have a dog in the room with me, and she's a French bulldog, so she sounds sort of part pig, part panting bulldog. So if you hear anything, it's that. It's not me, I assure you. So a bit about myself. I work at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability, which is in Putney in London, and we're a hospital that looks at supporting specifically patients with very severe brain injuries, including those with disorders of consciousness. I'm the principal clinical psychologist on the brain injury service. So that's, I specifically oversee the rehab service there. So I'm more focused on patients once they've emerged from disorders of consciousness and coming onto our wards, looking at more goal-directed neurorehabilitation. And then, like Cleena said, I have been doing a PhD for the last 4 years. So I took a thesis pending year because the ambition of trying to work full time, do a PhD full time, and get married meant I needed an extra year. So I am due to hand in the next couple of weeks. But that PhD was with the University of Glasgow, underneath John Evans and Breda Cullen, looking at how we assess mood in patients with very severe cognitive and communication impairments. And Cleena, you very kindly took part in that research. So
I did indeed, Alex.
Can I just ask whether the wedding went smoothly?
Wedding went as smoothly as it could. We got married at the Barbican, which is very, very Londony, and we were quite proud of our very London wedding. Nice. I've got lovely pictures of us. The bridal party took the tube to make it very Londony. It went very smoothly. And then I went immediately to a conference. So got married on the Saturday, and I was in Maastricht at the NeuroSig conference by the Tuesday.
A honeymoon most people would die for, I imagine.
Absolutely, yeah.
And presenting work from your PhD there, Alex, not just attending, right?
No, presenting. So lots of anxiety and stress. But I married somebody that's a doctor and also a PhD holder. So he's actually went to his own conference on the Friday, and I met him at his conference before we flew off on honeymoon. So, you know, we had our priorities straight, we feel.
We could spend the whole podcast, couldn't we, covering the nature of your relationship and how you make that work. But I'm suggesting we allow you a dignified exit. And Cleena's got some legitimate questions about areas of neuropsychology, so we can steer very carefully away from the I was drawing us into. Sorry about that, Alex.
I'm sure we'll probably steer back a little bit as well.
You
talk about kind of, you know, stress, but I'm sure we'll come back to that and how you manage that to a certain extent, particularly thinking about, you know, holding all of those different components of PhD, work, having a life, having a husband. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll curve back around to that. But before we do, we have a question that we generally ask our interviewees, attendees, mm-hmm. Podcast guests. And this is, can you tell us how you first got interested in neuropsychology?
That is thinking back. I think whenever I try and answer this question, because often trainees always ask about these types of things and wanting to know how you got interested in neuropsychology. Mine came from personal family experience. So my cousin had a brain aneurysm when he was 25, and I'm from South Africa. So we, as a family in South Africa, didn't really understand what the NHS would do in the situation. There isn't really funded neurorehabilitation in South Africa. If you have private medical insurance, you might get some stroke rehab, but there are no real pathways. So I was fascinated to sort of hear about his journey. I ended up volunteering in Headway in South Africa. And then, if I'm honest, I absolutely loved working at Headway. I, at that stage, was applying for clinical training and at the same time applying for a job at Headway, because I was like, well, if I don't get into clinical training, I'm going to work at Headway, because I absolutely loved it. And then I kind of, like I said, when I was studying, there wasn't really neuropsychology in South Africa. So I kind of crafted my own clinical training to make sure if there was anything to do with neuro in a placement that I had that experience. And then did the same when I worked in the psychiatric hospital. I worked on the older adults wards because they tended to have more neuropsych testing around dementia. And then I moved to the UK, knowing that there was more of a neuro rehab world out there. And I think I moved in the May, and I enrolled for the Glasgow postgraduate diploma in the September. So I was quite determined to get started. And yeah, actually, when I moved over, I really struggled to get a job in the NHS, because any of us that do NHS interviews know that a lot of the questions are around NHS policies and procedures and things like that. And I was completely clueless. But I had I then took a locum job role at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability. So Christy Bolter was there at the time, and she sort of as a Kiwi, she recognized that as another Antipodean, I might be struggling. And she sort of took pity on me, worked in challenging behavior with her for a few months, and she trained me up on how to answer NHS questions. But yeah, that's, I just turned on that the RHM was my first job when I moved over here as well.
It's a little bit of an aside, Alex, but yeah. I guess one of the questions, I don't want to kind of encourage you to feel too awkward, but do you think those questions about NHS structures, policy frameworks are legitimate? Or, I mean, do you think it was a barrier to you in terms of work?
It was absolutely a barrier, and I felt quite frustrated, because I think those are simple things I can learn very rapidly in a job setting. And there were more important questions, and I feel when I interview people, I like to ask more important questions to get a feel of what somebody's work ethic is like, their passion, things like that. So I sort of feel definitely a barrier. And you know, at the RHN they're less important, but we still have to ask, you know, the sort of HR institutional related questions to score them.
But I guess what you're saying is your experience has been there are more important questions you could ask neuropsychologist.
Absolutely.
Alex, I'm going to take you back a little bit as well, and kind of on that thread as well. What's training like in South Africa?
I mean, I will comment on training 10 years ago.
Yeah,
that's made me feel a bit old. But to be fair, I have come across somebody who trained in my old university. It sounds roughly similar. It's still very, very competitive. So there are, and I stand to be corrected, but less than 10 universities that do clinical psychology training in South Africa. And they accept around sort of 11 to 15 students per year cycle. So hence why I said I had a backup plan. I was not very confident that I was going to get in because it is just that competitive. And then we generally do, it's a 3-year course with practical training throughout it. And then in order to qualify to be clinical, you have to do a year of government service. So you work for a government hospital for a year, and that's, they can place you anywhere in the country for that. I find now that I supervise UK-based trainees that what I do know from that's different is we're very integratively trained in South Africa. It's working as a clinical psychologist in South Africa, you're almost just on the front line of a clinic. You're not specified into what you will be dealing with. It's just whatever the person brings. So that could, in a day, vary from, you know, social stresses to psychosis to HIV related cognitive decline. You know, your day was very varied. And clinical psychologists are expected to be able to diagnose according to ICD-10 and DSM-5 criteria, to log that with national insurance and private insurance. And we got a lot more psychiatric training diagnostically and sort of around what medications might be appropriate and being able to review medications. So, which is quite different, I think, from trainee experiences here. Here it's very sort of, you get competencies in your different areas and you work in specific settings, which I did know when I did my training. So that's why, like I said earlier, I try to structure my training, yes, for neuro, but I also knew in order to be equivalent in the UK, I had to cover older adults, children, adolescents, CBT competencies, all the things that they would need to tick me off in the HCPC. But yeah, very, very different experience, very different work settings. It's still fascinating to listen to my clinical psychologist colleagues over there because they see everyone and everything.
Yeah, I love that word. It's fascinating. And I think it's always interesting, isn't it, to hear about those differences in terms of training. And I think, you know, none of us do a doctorate in clinical psychology twice, do we? So you never, you know, you always have this slight fantasy about what other courses or courses in other countries are like, but we don't really know, except like kind of hearing about it and hearing people's experiences. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think you'll be getting an email cleaner from someone who has done a doctorate in clinical psychology twice. I'm not saying there are those people,
but I challenge
our audience.
I would wonder how many international people who have come over to the UK have had to actually redo what is basically all the practical components of a clinical doctorate again, because there isn't an easy way to just map on what their experiences is.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very different. And I've had trainees and psychologists work with us from, for example, from Italy and from Australia, where they've done neuropsychology training specifically and actually haven't done a lot of the clinical psychology training modules or experience those types of patients. So it's quite fascinating. I think it's a very varied box, which, you know, like you said, Ingram, means that, you know, being able to tell me what the five values of the organization are probably not the most important interview questions.
No. And I think, I mean, increasingly, and I mean, we talk about this quite a bit, don't we, Kleena, with regard to training and what it is to be a neuropsychologist. And I think that there always will be constraints around educational governance and professional standards that, you know, at times will seem arbitrary to individuals trying to get into something. And we're, I think equally, and obviously I'm involved in quite a bit of this work, or I am involved in quite a bit of this work. You know, we are looking for ways to be a bit more competency oriented in terms of the way we conduct interviews, in terms of the way we think about training. And I think there's a lot of work to be done there, particularly to support people who've pursued international routes to qualification, as you say. I suppose I wondered, Alex, you know, the kind of experience that you had around having to make sure you had that broad clinical experience. I mean, again, I suppose it's a bit like the NHS and values kind of question. Did any of those experiences feel irrelevant to your journey as a neuropsychologist? Did you feel you were just ticking boxes at that stage, given your determination to pursue neuropsychology? Because I suppose my experience training in clinical psychology with a defined interest in neuro is, I didn't see any of my clinical training as irrelevant to my practice.
I have really, really fond memories of all of my training in South Africa. Like, I really enjoyed it. And when I came to the UK and started the postgraduate diploma, I felt it was just a continuation of my training. So I felt it fit quite well. And I'm trying to think of the one that might be like the most, you know, opposite to neuro training. And I, you know, even then I'm like, I was going to say psychodynamic, but we got taught by Mark Soames and he does psychodynamic neuropsychology. So actually, nope, that still overlaps. Yeah, that's still relevant. You know, and I think it all just kind of came together in the end. And I often, you know, refer to your toolbox of things that you pull out every now and again. And certainly where I work, when you have to get creative, you might be pulling on things that are from, you know, very different areas that aren't just purely neuro.
Yes. So, and I guess there's also
all adds up.
There's a question of what do you know of neuropsychology if neuropsychology is all that you know, right? So we sort of need to embed our neuropsychological formulations. Obviously, they arguably are broad and holistic. Yeah. But if we think of neuropsychology in a narrow sense, we always have to embed that within a broader framework that can only really be understood if you've had a experience during training where you've got a slightly more diverse experience than just focusing on neuro.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I was always really happy with how dynamic the Glasgow course was when I did it, in that it wasn't just looking at testing and diagnostic stuff. It was a bit focused on formulation and thinking about systemic issues and things that are your bread and butter in clinical psychology, but you're just refining them to a neuro way of thinking. Because I think there's, you know, a danger in people just thinking, oh, brain is injured, I will pick up tests and I will tell you what the test results are, and that's the answer that you're looking for. Because it's not that, it's not that simple. And you know, coming from South Africa, I could never use a test. There were very few tests I could pick up that were, you know, had any norms or standardized or would even be considered culturally appropriate. So, you know, you really started from a perspective of formulating with functional difficulties that you saw, and listening to various reports from their family, from those that work with them, their own reports. So,
and it's interesting, isn't it? So the kind of flip side of that is that when we have tests available, when we have these huge test cupboards, it's really, it entices you in. You're, before you've even spoken to the person, you've got a plan and you've got loads of blocks and stopwatches, and there you go. And immediately you're kind of drawn into a way of thinking about the person in front of you that is through the lens of numbers and various technical aspects of test administration. Absolutely. And I guess your experience is about, you know, being held back for pragmatic reasons from that is actually quite advantageous.
Yeah, I think it's why I really enjoy working at the RHN, because, you know, from when you work with somebody who has a very severe brain injury and their cognition is so impaired that any test is going to be scores on the floor, it's not really going to tell you anything, you're not looking at going into your test cupboard, and that can promote a lot of anxiety and a bit of, you know, feeling helpless and you not sure what to do. But actually starting with the real basics. So, for example, this week we have a patient who's severely expressively aphasic, and the comment is that she's globally aphasic, where I was sort of like, I don't know, contextually she's getting a lot of things right. So I feel like it's just the language completely, you know, she's not disorientated. I think she's understanding a bit more. And so we went in and we played Connect Four and we played memory and we sorted some cards into suits and colors. And, you know, I think the trainee was so keen to know what the testing was behind that. And I was like, well, I learned a lot from playing those games with that person. I learned that she could strategize, that she had, you know, an ability to recognize when she was losing or getting tasks wrong, that she was able to self-monitor. I can't standardize any of that, but it tells me a lot about her function. And that opportunity to be creative, and perhaps I'm more likely to go into a test cupboard and think, is any of this going to work for me? Rather than pulling out tests and going off with a full backpack full of tests.
I look at a test cupboard and think, is any of this going to help me feel less anxious about the process I have? There are ways to flip that and say, look, tests give us confidence around some of those qualitative impressions we might get through informal means, but I guess all of this is about balance in our practice, isn't it? And about recognizing sometimes when we're using tests as a way of structuring an exchange with someone. And I think that's a legitimate reason sometimes to use a test or a structured approach. But knowing why you're doing it is a crucial thing.
Yeah, it makes me think it sort of comes with expertise. So the more you've tested in your career and the more confidence you have that you've got the ability to recognize something in front of you with your clinical reasoning and qualitatively, the less likely you are to go and pull out that test. And I think, you know, that was one of the themes in my PhD when it came to testing mood, is that the more experienced clinicians were less reliant on using screening tools. They would be quite confident that they could, you know, use other clinical interview plus information from others plus observations, but they didn't feel that they had to stick to, you know, a hospital anxiety depression scale, and they would be more reliant on that, whereas less experienced clinicians perhaps felt that this is what you're told to do. You're told to screen mood. The guidelines say, you know, after stroke within 6 weeks, and then at 3 months, and at 6 months, at 12 months, and you have to use a tool. So it was interesting that kind of overlaps with the same with cognitive testing, is that your clinical experience may make you more confident to step away from the pen and paper based tools and sort of use your clinical experience.
And I think there's something in that, Alex, isn't there? Like, kind of, you know, if we think about the patients that we work with, particularly the patients that you work with who have, you know, quite severe physical disabilities, quite severe cognitive disabilities, and it's often difficult to form that communication in a very traditional sense of speaking, the communication comes in a very different way, doesn't it? And I guess, yeah, just listening to you and Ingram interacting there, the thing that really strikes me is that neuropsychology is not manualized, it's not protocol driven. You know, it really is about that theoretical foundation and adding the experience onto that, isn't it? And
absolutely.
I think
there's a tendency to want to oversimplify things, to have a really simple flow chart of what you do, boxes to tick. They want a, you know, a manual on what you do, and that's just not the way it works. You know, the sort of outcome of my PhD has been that, you know, the danger around assessing mood when somebody can't self-report how they're feeling is that we're trying to oversimplify it. And actually, it's much more complex than just either picking up a pen and paper-based test or just looking at sleep, appetite, and tearfulness. That it's much more complicated than that. But there is just a human nature thing and wanting things to be a bit more straightforward. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not how it works.
And particularly for, you know, assistant psychologist trainees that are, you know, you're trying to learn, isn't it? It's very difficult to learn something when it's not written down as well. I think 100%. That's the thing that really excited me about your PhD. As you said, I took part in it, but I think the thing that really, really excited me was we're going to have something written down that kind of, not necessarily that it tells us what to do, but it tells us kind of some of the framework for why we might do things in a certain way.
Yeah, I can give you the framework. We haven't quite got there with the tool or anything like that. That's postdoc opportunities, I suspect. But I think, you know, coming back to what you were saying about assistants and trainees, there's an element of working, especially in more severe brain injury, where there's a sense of you need to be a little bit more vulnerable and the sort of tabula rasa, very boundaried therapist doesn't really work well in those settings. So, you know, I often encourage play in therapy and trying different things, but also you're going to be communicating with your voice, over communicating to show excitement when the words mean nothing and you're trying to just get the emotion across. Or, you know, you need to, the amount of times that I've made people dance or do something really daft as a distractor to break challenging behavior, which feels awkward and uncomfortable, but it works.
I wanted to ask you about that. I had an experience this week of doing something that I feel quite comfortable doing, but haven't done for a while. We were trying to get a child through a functional imaging protocol, mm-hmm. young child, 6 years old. She was quite distressed, understandably. She'd never had an unsedated scan before. I had a trainee and an assistant with me, and they'd not seen this done before. And so I was showing them how I would kind of work with a child, work with their anxiety or whatever. There's something about what they see, particularly that sort of playful, slightly more avant-garde context. One of the things that I struggle with is saying, well, I've sort of done what I do to try and sort of soften the edges of this process for this young person. And I've done it in a slightly jocular way, and I've joked about things, and we've got through that. But I'm not trying to suggest to them that they do exactly what I've done. And I think some of the things that you're saying are a bit tricky and challenging, aren't they, to people who are going through training, because we want the security of a manual. So Clean is saying it's not manualized, and you're saying, well, you can't do it in a tick boxy kind of way. But I'm guessing from your PhD, one of the outcomes is, yes, we can't just look at these things, but there are some guiding principles here. It's not as if we're going in and not knowing what we're doing or having a whole raft of techniques and there's no guidance around what you should choose. And I suppose I would argue that I was adhering to some principles around the understanding of this young person's anxiety and what it would do, how we might psychologically alleviate that anxiety and get the result that we needed, which was her going in the scanner, and not being distressed. So I suppose I wondered whether, particularly with those techniques that might be around using your voice and using slightly exaggerated nonverbal and verbal cues, whether you expect other people to mimic you in terms of their following your practice, or whether you expect them to find their own way and find something that's a bit more natural for them in terms of connecting with them.
Yeah, definitely the latter. It has to be congruent with what you're comfortable with. And me being, you know, maybe a bit more exuberant and outgoing when I'm working, that doesn't necessarily sit with everybody. There are other ways of working. But I think from our perspective, you know, within the RHM, where we push forward a sort of values-based approach, and we do all of our goal setting in a values-based way, where it is really about what's important to the person, rather than, you know, what's the sort of clinical objective here for somebody's admission. So always a simple one. Most people, when they set a goal and they're in a wheelchair, their goal will be to not be in the wheelchair, to be able to walk. So we manage a lot of expectations around that, because most of our patients will leave our wards as wheelchair users. So we look at, like, okay, well, what's the value around wanting to walk? Where do you want to go? Is it about independence? How can we support that? Sometimes it's about, I see my mates every Wednesday at the pub and play darts. So how can we support that happening whilst in a wheelchair, and work on goals such as self-propelling or being able to throw darts or being able to order a pint from the pub clearly with their voice? So we sit with the values, and then that also influences how you interact with the person. So if somebody values humor and distraction and doesn't want to talk about how bad things are, that's the way you'll approach, even when they are distressed, trying to do a very physical task. You're going to go with what they would find appropriate. But definitely I would expect trainees and other people I work with to do things in their own way. I think we all work slightly differently, but we remain sort of patient-centered at the heart of it. Yeah. But I think one of the things that I maybe do tell trainees to do what I do is physical contact with patients. It's really, really important when somebody's got a severe brain injury. It can guide somebody's attention back to you. It can help them feel safe in a moving or transfer task. And it's something that it's just broaching that what we normally do in clinical therapy versus in neuro rehab, where their body is not working how they want it to, and you might have to get involved with that.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm a big proponent of MDT working. So joint sessions, as many people working on things together as possible, I think is really beneficial and helps anybody who's not experienced at neuro rehab get that quite quickly or feel less anxious about it, because there are other experts in the room.
Yeah. And I think it's, I have a small confession to make, Ingram. I don't think I've even shared this with you, but I have been to, as it's called locally, Putney, to see Alex at work. And I've had a visit around the whole grounds and seen all the units with a very generous guide in Alex. And I think there's something very special, isn't there, Alex, about where you work?
Yeah, there is a... There isn't, we call it the RHN factor. There just is a factor. We are a charity funded hospital that has an NHS contract. So it means that, you know, the NHS pays all of our salaries and funds the sort of brain injury service. But the charity side of it just uplifts things. So we have extra things like every team has a music therapist, and we have occupational therapy, you know, outings and kitchen settings. We've got a team of art girls who do sort of art-based tasks and create things. And everybody's really, really passionate in sort of finding ability in the severe disability. And I think it just comes with a sense of teamwork that makes you want to keep trying. Because I think, you know, what we haven't touched on is obviously in severe brain injury, these devastating brain injuries can leave you really feeling sort of helpless and hopeless, because somebody might not make massive changes throughout their rehab journey. They might be small increments, might be quality of life. I mean, saying that, some patients make tremendously impressive recoveries. And I think Barbara Wilson's always the champion of never say never. A lot of people go on to recover for years and years afterwards. But I think it's important that we as a team find ways to keep things, you know, uplifting and motivating.
I've got kind of a two-part question for you next, Alex. Bear with. Hold on to that working memory. You've kind of answered this already. Like, obviously, this was your first job in the UK. Well, you came to the Royal Hospital kind of initially, and then worked kind of like with people with challenging behaviour. And then obviously now you're kind of the lead kind of in terms of rehab.
I did leave. I left and came back. I did. I similar to my clinical training, where I wanted to make sure I'd seen a bit of everything to know what I wanted to do. I very, very systematically went through stroke rehab, early supported discharge. What else did I do? Acute hospital setting, dementia care services, and private practice. And then I came back to Putney.
Yeah. What keeps you there?
The people. Both the patients, but the team, you know, there are people that have been working in Putney for over 40 years, and, you know, love coming to work, but it means that, you know, I've been there for 7 years now on the brain injury service, and I work with the same ward staff. So we learn together, we work together. It's also just something different every day. I can tell you what meetings I have, but I cannot tell you what my day will look like, because I know that it's just going to be something really weird and wonderful. And, you know, it's an organization that I feel quite proud to work for. They focus on taking care of their staff. There's a lot of well-being programs, which I think are quite important. We have things like Founders Week every year, where we play, you know, we have a sports day with the patients, and we play rounders, and we get an ice cream truck that comes. So it's just, for me, it's a way to work within the NHS, but perhaps not feel as burnt out as I felt working within acute services. I will be honest that I struggled quite a lot with that. I felt long waiting lists, pressure. You know, I like to be able to get to everybody. And I think when I worked particularly in like dementia community services, I just never got to the bottom of my list. Mm-hmm. It just never happened. But yeah, the people keep me coming back, I think, is the short answer there.
Yeah. And the second part to my question, which, you know, I've given it like separately, so not so taxing on your working memory.
But you
talked about values earlier and kind of values led goals. I'm just wondering if you could share with us and with our listeners a little bit about what are the values that get ignited in you from working with people with quite significant disabilities and their families? Like, what does that do for you in terms of your approach to life?
I think there's something for me in terms of being useful and being helpful. I think both with the patients and with their families, it's a point of them really not knowing what to do. So even just providing information and sort of containing a lot of that anxiety around the process and what's happened. So that sort of feeling useful. I also like the charitable side of the hospital. I think, you know, that really taps in, you know, in South Africa, we are brought up with always doing something for charity in some way. So I think that ties in for me as well, but also fun. I think we are always really creative, and we do just lots of different things that makes work fun, and then also makes rehab more fun to participate in. And it's not, you know, repetitive, boring tasks. We try to make it as fun as possible, obviously acknowledging that when you have severe physical impairments, there's less that you can do for yourself. So they are really reliant on us to bring that fun and bring activities that are enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah. It's lovely, isn't it? It's like, what a lovely way to go to work.
It isn't intended to be a provocative question, but I wasn't quite sure how to ask this. But I suppose my clinical experience has been, I've crossed paths with inpatient neurorehabilitation, and one of the difficulties, I suppose, for me in seeing myself in that context has been about what might be absent from that context. So a kind of frustration, certainly when working within the team, around, well, we're talking about a particular phase of this person's rehabilitation, and at some point they'll go home and the real challenges will start then. So it's almost as if like the really hard work comes outside of the inpatient. I'm not saying your work, but in that context. So it has felt on occasion to me like a bit of a bubble where you can create motivation and engagement and a sense of, you know, drawing on a whole range of skills, as you've already pointed out, in terms of the creativity and the passion and determination of the team. But then someone goes back to the real world, and you know, that pub with a dartboard isn't quite as accessible as it could be. There are steps and the bar's too high. And I do wonder whether you share that kind of frustration or sense of artificiality in terms of the context in which you work. And is that something you have a way of managing?
I mean, I definitely share that. And I think a lot of it, we can sometimes approach the discharge planning process feeling quite hopeless because, you know, at the moment we're recognizing that there's just not a lot of community support because there are posts that are empty, it's oversubscribed, it's a, you know, 8 to 10 week waiting list. So, you know, alongside all of that fun and enjoyment, we're also doing some preparation of this is going to come to an end. And it's, you know, the reality is this is really different, and your life is going to be really different. But yeah, it definitely is. It is a bubble. It's an odd bubble because we're doing the sort of things that maybe you don't see unless there is a severe brain injury. So that's sort of, we almost conceptualize it like it's not post-traumatic amnesia, but it's definitely, there's no new learning for an extended period of time. So you're doing rehab with people who, you know, aren't retaining things and are doing things quite spontaneously and trying to manage that in context. So often we get to, if somebody stays with us for their full 180-day admission, they're only just starting to be able to function properly in the community. And then we find there's not always somebody to hand it over to and say, this is what we've noticed, this is what should happen next, and we really hope you're there. A lot of the time it kind of feels like we're just dropping them into the ocean and really hoping it works out. So I do think that's something that we're lucky in that we have you know, we have a large psychology team, we've got debriefing, and we talk about these sort of feelings of helplessness or pointlessness sometimes of we've done all this hard work, and actually if somebody doesn't support this person, they're just going to stay in bed or stay in their wheelchair, and it's not going to get any better for them. I try wherever possible to empower family members. I spend a lot of time with them, being quite like brutally honest about things like you're saying, bars aren't accessible, there are steps. You know, if this is really a goal, can we look into what is accessible in your neighborhood? You know, we're very blunt about rehousing when houses aren't going to be appropriate. We always ask the really, you know, we sort of set it as on day 3 or 4 of their admissions, one of us will be asking, look, if nothing changes for your loved one, can they come home as they are in a wheelchair with a tracheostomy in place? All these things that are scary to deal with and make things complicated. And we do as much as we can to help them think about the real world, because like you say, it's a bubble. And they come to realize that there's a lot of anxiety when having to leave us and be discharged, because, you know, the safety of the bubble goes away. So I mean, I don't know what's happening in the community because I don't work in the community, but I know I have a lot of friends who have left to go into private practice and don't really work in their community jobs anymore and things like that. So I think the last time I got a neuropsychology person to take over from me in the community was you, Cleena, when you were doing your Southwest London project. It's definitely definitely a bubble, and there's a lot of anxiety around what happens to the person and the family when they leave. I think we're very good at recognizing it as well. So sometimes we'll be 2 weeks into admission, we'll be like, oh, I'm worried about this one. You know, especially if somebody doesn't have a family member, then you sort of start trying to pull together community resources wherever you can.
But I think that's the really difficult thing, isn't it? As someone who has tended in the past to work in the community, it is really difficult, isn't it? Because there's that, you know, without getting into a big political statement on our podcast, but there's geographical discrepancies. And as you say, there's vacant posts, and there's posts that, you know, just, you know, that community service hasn't been commissioned in places. And, you know, I know I've certainly received, I say received in inverted commas, like kind of a few of your folks back when I worked in Kent and kind of, you know, and in Southwest London. And I think the thing that always stood out for me in terms of the people, you know, whose journey had come through Putney was that there's lots of paperwork around somebody. There's lots and lots of guidance that you guys really spend a lot of time, not just in the inpatient bubble, but in the thinking about that. How do we transition? And it's always been incredibly valuable from my point of view. Yeah. From the other end, it's always been incredibly valuable.
I think that's, you know, maybe our attempt at trying to empower people to you know, do as much as possible and not underestimate the person, and also not feel overwhelmed, because it might be overwhelming to look at this person and all their complex needs, but actually we've done a lot of the work. We know it's, you're gonna follow these steps, it'll be okay. I think, you know, there's an element of, because it will come up in supervision again and again when people work at the RHN, and that sort of being comfortable with you've done everything you can. You know, we often refer to it as we don't have a magic wand, because the real solution, if we had the magic wand, was to take away the brain injury to begin with. You know, and we don't have access to that magic wand. So it's about, you know, being happy with it, that you've done everything you can, rather than, you know, letting that follow you around. It would be difficult to come to work every day.
Yeah.
If you didn't feel that you were doing everything you could.
And as you said,
recognizing you can't fix it.
And it's that sense, as you said, it's about empowering kind of the family. It's empowering the people who are going to be on the long-term journey, isn't it? The journey for life.
Absolutely.
Rather than the journey for this chapter.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Alex Ingram has in the past had a quiz for his guest.
We tried to bury it cleaner, but you insisted on dusting it off.
I thought Alex would enjoy the quiz.
Thanks. Just for me.
So just for the listeners' benefit, I have indicated this was ill-advised. And we welcome views.
I just want to say I'm quite impulsive, so I might change my answers if you ask me again tomorrow.
Well, there are very few rules, Alex, in this quiz, and very little points to it.
Great.
I have to add. But I have been scanning your questions. I was, a sort of wry smile crept across my face, Cleaner, while you were talking, because I was trying to work out which questions I might get landed with if we alternate. But my view is that you should go first.
Okay.
Poor Alex, she can't dodge any of these questions.
They're all for me.
And you haven't seen the questions, Alex.
They're all forced choice questions.
Forced choice.
And many of them are entirely meaningless.
Okay, great.
Okay. Boston or Wessex?
Wessex.
Cleaner, what does that mean?
Oh, so it's the Wessex head injury matrix that's indistinct from Boston naming test.
Won't require footnotes.
If you're going to think about which tests I'm likely to pull out, Wessex.
So it's...
dogs or cats, Alex?
Dogs.
We haven't, despite you saying your dog would be making some kind of auditory appearance, I've heard very little from her.
You've mentioned her.
Come on, Rosie.
Not that anybody can see
her.
Oh,
here she is. Right. So, I mean, this.
Can you make a noise?
She is beautiful, isn't she?
She is very pretty.
I might just do a little screenshot, Alex, because we're going to need this for the Twitter. Here we are. Got it.
Rosie has performed beautifully for our audience listeners.
Thank you, Rosie. We've got a few questions for Rosie later on.
She also says dogs.
Next question. Mayo or hummus?
Mayo.
Somewhat controversial. Glasgow or Edinburgh?
Glasgow. That was a tough one, but Glasgow.
It is tough. You've just alienated a large number of the audience.
Safari or beach?
Beach.
Oh, people can't see your face right now, Alex.
I know.
But
it's very strange. I feel that I might have let down some South African heritage there. No, beach. Still beach.
Lena, I'm pleased I've got this one, because I've just noticed a rather interesting typo in that you've invented a whole new brain structure, which is one that I would love. But I think the intended question is hippocampus or amygdala, Alex?
Amygdala.
Can I say what we've got down here?
Please do.
We've got a hippothalamus, which is a which is a large semi-aquatic thalamus.
And this is why you should not write quiz questions at midnight.
This is why.
Just blame Word.
This is why this has to stop.
Plane or boats, Alex?
Plane. I get seasick.
Oh.
I've got, is it sods or hads?
Hads.
Do we need a footnote for this? Because Cleaner and Alex know exactly what this question's about.
You go, yeah. Alex.
I haven't got a clue.
Well, the sods and the hads are two mood screens. One is, you know, the signs of depression severity scale. The sods is assumed to be better if you have communication and cognitive impairments, but I'm going to say it's not. Oh. Hence, if you have the cognitive and communication ability, I don't really have a problem with the hads. There is new research out that says that the hads is actually not really looking at depression and anxiety specifically, but rather just general distress, which I think if we look at it from that perspective, it's quite useful. But when there is cognitive and communication impairments presence that sort of limit self-report and obscure a lot of the behavioral things that you would be looking for to make a diagnosis, I would just step away from the pen and paper based tests entirely. My systematic review showed that none of them actually included people with severe cognitive impairments when they were validated. And that includes the SODs and the DISCs, which were designed for people with more severe impairments. There's the sort of acknowledgement that they couldn't validate them on the patient population of interest. So I'll stick with that.
Quite shocking.
So Alex, you have redeemed the quiz by explaining your almost entire PhD with a starting point being a forced choice question about.
There we go.
See, it's worth bringing the quiz back.
Do we think that I could ask people in my Viber to just only ask me forced choice questions?
This will be the future of PhD Vivers.
Yeah.
I accept.
Next question, you know, it's a really taxing one. Pink or yellow?
Yellow.
I'm thinking custard, right?
You can't see the room as I see it. Literally, all my carpet, everything is yellow. Yellow is just my favorite color.
Well, this is a slightly related question. Barbie or Oppenheimer?
Barbie. Haven't seen Oppenheimer yet.
Is the right
but
answer.
But Barbie was great.
What would you say, Kleenex? Barbie or Oppenheimer?
Barbie. So yeah. Keen to see it.
That's like three Barbies.
So good. So good.
I only heard third-party reports from my daughters about Barbie, but the reports were so good. I am going to have to get out of my chair.
You need to watch. Yeah, my husband really enjoyed it. Like, yeah. It's not just for the ladies.
Something for the Kens as well in this world.
Something
right?
for the Kens.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, we usually finish by returning to some of the questions that we haven't answered. So we're probably going to give Alex about 2 minutes to explain her entire PhD, unless she did so in the sods versus has question already. But are there any other things that any sort of, I don't mean to trample on your questions, Cleaner. Alex is very much your guest, but I feel like I've got to know Alex a little bit, and it gives me a license to ask a few questions of my own. But I suppose I wondered, Alex, were there sort of key learning points from your PhD, things that you'd want people to know about, things that you discovered along the way?
In terms of my actual findings or just my experience of doing a PhD?
Findings. I'm just thinking we've shortchanged you a bit with your PhD, and I'm just thinking, are there things that sort of, the things that you learned along the way that were either formally part of the PhD or things that you want clinicians working in this area to know about?
Yeah, so I think from a sort of findings perspective, I think I started this PhD from a clinical problem. I am working with a patient population where whenever somebody wanted to ask about their mood, they would ask, have you done a HADS? Have you done a PHQ? And I would have to give a very long, convoluted answer of why I haven't done it. And when I presented that to John Evans as a possible master's adjunct to the postgraduate diploma, he sort of said, that's a PhD project. And I'm, you know, going to be flippant and say, I feel like if John Evans says that he's going to supervise you doing a PhD, you say yes. It's not something that you necessarily easily say no to. And, you know, out of my PhD, I had hoped to actually create a tool to help people working in this population to make it more straightforward. But as is with most PhD projects, the project was bigger than I ever expected it to be. And actually what I've done is sort of set the groundwork for what the current clinical practice is and what people out there that see these patients are doing and advise not doing. Like I said earlier, my systematic review only found two measures that had actually included those with cognitive impairments, and those are both aphasia depression rating scales, so the aphasia, the ADRS, and the stroke aphasia depression questionnaire. But again, it was only in a paper with 25 people, so very small study. So it all came down to formulation. So back on those clinical psychology school skills of thinking about what's all the information you've got. Do you have a hypothesis? Test that hypothesis. That reinforms your information and you're going to be reformulating. So it's almost an iterative process. But I suppose what I'd want clinicians working with patients after brain injury to just think about is the role of cognition. Because I think a lot in my clinical experience, people think somebody is depressed or it's their mood that's limiting their engagement, but actually it's their cognition. They are too cognitively impaired to understand, or they have initiation impairments that actually stop them from completing tasks independently. Things that, you know, essentially look like they might be mood. And then there's a storyline that comes out of that, because mood does still have a stigma around it about effort and trying and, you know, doing better and if medication can help. And I think just being aware that it's not as simple as that, but to usually start with cognition first and then think about mood. And then I suppose things that I've learned about the PhD, it's bigger than you think it will be. It's more about learning how to do research than it is about your topic. You learn a lot. As a clinician going into research, I had to really practice being an academic. So sometimes it feels like you already know the answer because you've got some anecdotal experience of it, but actually the research isn't there. So you have to do all the steps to get there. And that can be quite humbling. Mm. Yeah, but it's been a really great journey in terms of networking and getting to know people and travel. And, you know, I'm very privileged in my supervisors and their sort of support in making sure that even during a pandemic, I was able to sort of get to conferences and meet people and sort of progress my career. So, but unless you're really passionate about research and your topic, think carefully about PhDs. It's literally been my life for 4 years.
Alex, thank you so much for, I think, sharing your professional experiences, your research experience, and also your personal experiences. You've been a wonderful guest with us here on the NeuroClinic. So thank you very much from me.
Thank you, Alex. It's been wonderful talking to you about a whole range of things, very few of which you were explicitly prepared for. So thank you for being so generous.
Thanks for having me.